So welcome everyone for our review, really, of Parshat Balak, Parshat Pinchas, and a little bit of Matot, but essentially we're going to focus tonight on Bilam, the man who knew the mind of God. Now, the story of Bilam superficially seems decidedly different in the ambiance. Almost seems a little Disney-esque. You have a talking donkey, and you have a guy who purports to be able to curse, but in the end, it's kind of a little bit of a lampoonish buffoon who doesn't get to do anything that he pretends, to the point where when King Balak says goodbye, Balak says, I offered you the world, and you're going away with no stocks, no money, nothing, because you really were a big failure. So we see almost a Bilam as a massive failure, almost like a lampoonish character. And of course, gave us a movie, right? Anybody remembers the great, I don't know if it was Pixar or Disney, whoever made that movie, Shrek and the Talking Donkey. There's no question that the movie was all about the Eddie Murphy-voiced donkey, the voice of reason, which is no question plagiarized from the Talking Donkey from the story of Bilam. So it sounds like a very strange story. And Bilam himself says, I know the mind of God. And as we're going to see tonight, the rabbis say, okay, you know the mind of God? No one else does, but you know it, really? How about the mind of your donkey? How did you do there? And we know that every step of the way, the donkey got the better and embarrassed and shamed Bilam. So how is it that he claims to know the mind of God? And when he says this, it's in the Torah, it's a truth on some level. So we need to understand a little bit more about who Bilam is and perhaps take it out of the realm of the lampoonish, buffoonish area and try to make him more of a flesh and blood human being. So let's begin with source number one, Bilam, the man who knew the mind of God. Now, what shows us the gravitas, the import of this man, is that the Torah ends with a direct comparison between the greatest person who ever lived, perhaps, Moses, Moshe Rabbeinu, and Bilam. For the Torah says at the very, very end, V'lo kam od navi b'Yisrael k'moshe. They're like the third last verse of the entire Torah says, and there never again rose among the Jewish people a prophet as great as Moses. The rabbis say, among Israel there was no one who ever arose as great as Moses. Yes, sure, there was no Jewish prophet, but there was one who arose among the nations of the world, among the Umot HaOlam. This was so that the nations of the world would not have an excuse to say, had we had a prophet like Moses, we too would have served God. And who was the prophet like Moses that the nations of the world were given, and is alluded to at the very end of our Torah? This was Bilam ben Baor, our Bilam. So clearly, this comparison between Moses, Bilam, Bilam, Moses, that he is the Moses for all intents and purposes for the rest of the world, tells us that maybe we need to take this man a little more seriously. And even more than that, there are two times in Pirkei Avot, in the Ethics of Our Fathers, it's not in your source material tonight, where there are mentions of Bilam. One is in the context of the talking donkey, that at the very end of the Genesis project, God is about to rest on the first Sabbath, Shabbat number Yom HaShishi. It says he took time out to create 10 wonders, things that are beyond nature, that could not be created once the Genesis project is closed. In other words, the potential for these things had to be woven into the fabric of creation at that moment. And one of them was Pi Ha'aton, the mouth of the Shrek talking donkey from Bilam. It's right there. So God is like closing out Genesis, and he says, wait a minute, got to think about the character of the Bilam, the talking donkey, got to put the potential. Now we know the talking donkey didn't speak with an Eddie Murphy-like accent, and they communicated in whatever way they communicated, but that somehow was a part of Genesis. Not only that, but then in Pirkei Avot it says, in Ethics of Our Fathers, the famous Mishnah, it says that there are two possibilities in this world that you can be a student of one or the other, but these are the only choices. You can be a student of Abraham, or you can be a student of Bilam. Now how so? Who's a student of Abraham? And it talks about the characteristics of the one who would choose the path of Abraham, our patriarch. Or you could be a Talmid of Shel Bilam HaRasha. And if you're haughty and arrogant and have, you know, great self-serving motivation, you are a student of Bilam. Now, as crazy as it sounds, if you look around our world today, and we'll perhaps close with us tonight, you have to ask yourself the following question. Who has more students in the world today? Abraham or Bilam? We'll come back to this at the end of tonight. So then if Ethics for Our Fathers is using Bilam, this little bit of a lampoonish character, as the paradigm for the dark side and paralleling him with Abraham, and we already have the parallel at the end of the book of the Torah, of Devarim, of Deuteronomy, with Moses and Bilam, this is not a small issue. Somehow we need to understand a little bit more about him. Okay? So what was the problem that brought Bilam into this? Bilam, according to Midrashic lore, was actually in Egypt at the time of Moses. He knew him peripherally. Why was he there? He was one of the counselors to Pharaoh. And he's the one who came up with the plan to subjugate the Jews, to kill the Jews, the infanticide, throwing the little Jewish boys into the Nile, all that fun stuff was the dark influence that Bilam had. He was then exiled. He lost favor with Pharaoh for whatever reason. He goes out, he goes away. Now his name is Bilam, without a nation. He was essentially a sorcerer for hire. And people would hire him for little jobs and big jobs. And in fact, we know that Balak himself, the king of Moab, hires him in our parsha of Balak. You know why he hires him? Because he has intimate firsthand knowledge of the power of Bilam. Because he, Balak, became the king, even though he wasn't really a Moabite himself. He's brought in. All of this was foretold by Bilam. And Bilam helped them defeat the mighty giant Sihon. So Balak knew that he could curse, and the power of cursing was something that he was great at. Now, just as a little side point, if you go to Amman, Jordan, which I haven't been there personally, but they are friends with Israel now, you can go across the border crossing there into Jordan, they have a museum, an archaeological museum in Amman, Jordan, and they discovered an amulet that was dated by carbon dating back to the time of our story. And on the amulet, it's written in a weird mixture of Aramaic, which would have been the language of Bilam, because he was from across the river. He's a descendant of Laban, the Aramean. That's Aramaic. And this amulet is a curse. It's a very graphic curse on a person's genitals. And it's signed by Bilam ben Beor. And the amulet goes on to talk about what a great guy he is, and that, and it's dated. So it's very strange. Now, was this before he was hired, to curse the Jews after? But it's actually right there on display in this museum. I'd love to see it at some point in my life. But it's actually Bilam ben Beor in Aramaic. So there's actual evidence, archaeological evidence, to the existence of this character that we're talking about. And it dates him and it places him as a sorcerer of great renown. So in somebody's eyes, he was a hero. He was a heroic figure. Number two. So Balak cannot take on the Jews militarily. How does he know this? Because the Jewish people have triumphed over the mightiest warrior of all time, Og, the giant king of Bashan. So he thinks to himself, Balak does. He's a smart guy. He says, look, if Og can't stand up to this Jewish menace, what hope do I, as the king of Moab, have to militarily defeat the Jewish people? So he asked his cohorts, you need to help me here. Balak said, what is the strength of the Jews? How can they win every war when militarily they're not so well trained? How did they defeat Og and his half-brother Sihon, the mighty giants? So he dispatched messengers to a place called Midian. And if you recall, Moses was 60 years in Midian with Jethro, with Yisro. He married the daughter, right? Before he comes to the burning bush and is sent back as the emissary of God, he's there in Midian. That's where he kind of grew up, if you will. So when they go to Midian and they report back to King Balak, they say, this Moshe Rabbeinu, this Moses character, he's not conventionally strong. He doesn't have military prowess as such. But boy, does he have the gift of speech. Now, it's kind of ironic, because how did Moses define himself at the bush, remember? But God, I'm not a man of words, right? But yet, what does it mean, a man of speech, the power of speech? Tefillah, that he can speak to God, and God listens. So Balak found out that the secret to Jewish supremacy in these military conflicts that were happening as they approached the promised land of Israel. Time and time again, they win, they vanquish the enemy. It's through the koach ha-dibur, it's through the power of the speech. Now, we know this because Isaac told us. Remember back in Genesis, Isaac is blessing Jacob, who he believes to be Esau. Remember what he said to him? He says, boy, ha-kol kol Yaakov, that voice is the voice of Jacob. V'ha-yadayim, but the physicality, the hands, yaday Esau, they feel like the hands of Esau because he felt the goat skins and the hairiness. But that phrase defined forever the Jewish people versus the nations of the world. Ha-kol, the prayer, the power of speech, that defines Jacob, Israel. Ha-yadayim, but the physicality, the power of war, that's the rest of the world. So we tried, Balak thinks to himself, we tried to use the power of Esau to subdue the Jewish people time and time again. No effect. Now let's usurp, if you will, their power of prayer, and let's use it to destroy them. And there's only one person in the world who is capable of this. And who do you think that might be? The opposite, the dark side of Moses. Moses' polar mirror opposite, Bilam. So he goes and gets Bilam, and he brings Bilam, and he offers him tremendous wealth to come and to curse the Jewish people using the power of speech. So, number two. So now please come and curse this people for me, King Balak says to Bilam through his emissaries, for they are too powerful for me. Perhaps I will be able to wage war against them and drive them out from the land, for I know, Balak says to kind of play to the ego of Bilam, very, very arrogant man, that whomever you, Bilam, bless is blessed, and whomever you curse is cursed. For I know, Rashi says, through the war of Sihon against Moab, Balak knew that you helped him defeat Moab. In other words, Balak has intimate knowledge, as we alluded to, of the possibility of Bilam using the speech to destroy. He's already done it. He's been there. He has proof. All right, Balak sends emissaries to Bilam. They haven't met face to face. And he offers them his entire gold reserve in Fort Knox, Moab. Now, what happens? He sends the emissaries to Bilam. And Bilam is told by God, don't go. And then God says something stunning to Bilam. Number three, he asks him a question. God says to Bilam, and he does not want Bilam to go to be a party to Balak's nasty overtures. So he asks him, he says, by the way, who are these men with you? Mi hanashim. So stop for a second. So Bilam thinks to himself, who are these men with me? But you're God. Well, what? Oh my gosh. Bilam gets a revelation. Look, it came to delude him. These words that God asked were specifically put out there by God to give voice to the thoughts of Bilam, that maybe God's a little bit of an absentee landlord. Rashi means by asking, who are these men with you, that God meant to enter into a conversation with Bilam. That's all. He knew who they were, but he was just asking in a nice cordial way to enter into conversation to attempt to dissuade him from going with Balak's emissaries. But Bilam didn't see it that way. No. He already had a hidden agenda. But it came to Bilam to delude him, for he erred. Bilam said, maybe, sometimes. Not everything is revealed before him, before God, for he is not always omniscient. I will find a time when I'm able to curse, and God won't even realize that I'm cursing. Stop. So this is a profound idea. God tells Bilam, don't go. Don't go with Balak's emissaries. Bad idea. Bilam knows, look, whatever God wants, he gets. Whatever he doesn't, it's not going to happen without God's permission. But then God throws something out there deliberately in a very sort of obscure, neutral way. And Bilam can take it this way or that way. God says, well, who are these guys with you? Who are these emissaries? He knows full well who they are. But Bilam thinks, who are they? Must be that God cares about the big picture. But, little details, he lets it slide. He's going, he's doing other stuff. Wherever God goes, he's involved with other things. He's not really concerned about these mundane little day-to-day things. Because otherwise, why is he asking me who these people are? So Bilam believed then that he could go against the will of God and God wouldn't be aware because he just doesn't care. He's not so involved and engaged in our world. So he goes anyways. Now, as they're going along, this is where God opens the mouth of the donkey, and three times the donkey stops and pushes away because God has sent an angel in front of Bilam with a sword drawn. The donkey, the animal, sees the angel. Bilam does not see the angel. Now, everyone mistakenly thinks that the donkey's there to protect the Jewish people. It's not true. The donkey was created, as we mentioned at the outset, during the Genesis Project, not amazingly, to save the Jews, because the Jewish people, as you're going to see, are saved by God himself. He protects us against the curse. So what's the donkey supposed to be? A protector of Bilam. In other words, even though the guy is a gross individual, as we'll talk about, really a subhuman individual in many ways, morally anyways, God doesn't want him to go. God says, who are these people with you? Because he doesn't want him to go with. He says, these guys are beneath you. You are Bilam. You could be the Moses of the world. And you're going to involve yourself in petty little curses? You're going to allow yourself to be the sorcerer for hire and degrade yourself? So the donkey is there to get a message across. It's a powerful message. Think about it for a moment. God says to Bilam, you're the world's greatest prophet. Okay, I'll strip you of your prophetic abilities and give them to your donkey. So the donkey sees the angel, you, Bilam, will not. How do you like that? And instead of getting the message of, oh my gosh, God is engaged, God gave me temporarily whatever power I have that I better defer to him. No. He starts to get angry. What does he do? He starts to beat the donkey. And the donkey then says, why are you hitting me? You're going to curse the Jewish people with words and destroy them. Really? But me, your donkey, why don't you just curse me and I'll drop dead? You have to hit me with a stick? So you're using physical force against me and you are selling yourself to Balak and the rest of the world as if you have the power of words. Use words. Now, it's interesting. I pointed this out. Who else was told to speak but ended up hitting? Yeah. Isn't that amazing? And when it happened in the parsha before, by the way, before Balak, Chukad, right? He's told to talk to the rock and he ends up hitting the rock. And here you have his opposite, the dark side of Moses, Bilam, who is also supposed to go to talk, to curse, and he ends up hitting. Interesting. Just whatever that means, is clearly the connection, the parallel is striking between those, between the two scenes. Okay. Bilam then explains to Balak his failure in number 4. So after the incident of the talking donkey, Shrek's donkey, Bilam has been embarrassed and shamed in front of King Balak's emissaries. I mean, you can only imagine the next day, you know, he meets Balak. And then the, you know, emissaries of Balak who were with Bilam and witnessed the exchange. Now, obviously, they're not talking Aramaic even. I don't know how they're communicating with the donkey, but clearly the donkey is getting the better of him each way. And I'm sure the emissaries went, King Balak, before you write that check out, we want to tell you about a little incident that happened yesterday. You know, come here for a second. You remember you bought this guy for, you know, they tell him about the talking donkey. So it was a very big, shameful, embarrassing scenario for Bilam to have to tolerate this, but he went ahead with it. And Balak finally meets him, he offers him his bank account, anything you want. So Bilam says, no worries, but beware. I'm only going to do what God says I should do. Wink, wink. Because Bilam has in the back of his mind that God is not going to be aware and I'll sneak it in from left field when he's not paying attention. So what does he say? Number 4. If the Lord has not been angered, King Balak, I myself am powerless, except that I can determine the precise moment when God becomes angry. And he has not become angry all these days since I have come to you. Stop. It's a stunning idea. This is from Numbers 23, Rabbi Shlomo Yitzhaki Rashi. So Bilam admits now, I really don't have the power to curse, but I have a power that no one else has. I can calculate the moment when God gets angry. Now, before we go any further, the Gemara, the Talmud now, in number 5, is going to tell us like an amazing insight into this. Okay, so we have to read through number 5. Okay, I'll read it with you. Rabbi Yochanan said in the name of Rabbi Yossi, This is from Berachot. Blessings, Tom. How do you know that we must not try to appease a person in the time of his anger? That when a person is really angry, just let them cool off. Don't try to apologize. Don't try to do anything. Just let them be angry. It's going to be better if you wait a few days for them to cool down. How do we know this? For it is written, God said to Moses, Panai yelechu, my face, my countenance will go, v'hanichoti lach, and I will give you rest. Stop. In the aftermath of the golden calf, God was, shall we say, angry with the Jewish people. So he says to Moses, look, don't talk to me. Don't try to save the Jews at this moment. Let my countenance, my face of anger go away. And then, and only then, when I'm no longer angry, then you can appease me with words. The Holy One, blessed be He, said to Moses, wait until my countenance of anger has passed, and then I shall give you rest. Stop. And then the Talmud asks a very bizarre question. But is anger then a mood of the Holy One, blessed is He? Stop. That's a crazy question. Does God get angry? Well, gee, look kind of anywhere in the Torah, and every time the Jewish people complain or do something really bad, it says Vayichar, or Af Hashem, God's anger, and He struck them with this, with that. What kind of question is that? Of course God gets angry. But that's not what the Talmud's asking. What is the Talmud asking? We know God gets angry in response to sin. But what about, like, just anger for the sake of anger? What if there was, like, a random time every day where God gets angry? Now, let's stop for a second. I don't want you to get the wrong idea here. When we say God gets angry, we are anthropomorphizing in a very profound way. We're trying to put, you know, human understanding on what it would mean, God's wrath, God's anger. So I believe the question is like this. Does God get angry every day at a specific time? Yes. What does that mean? Well, God created the world. It says, Bereshit bara Elohim et ha-shamayim ve'et ha-aretz. God created the heavens and the earth. But we know the word for God used there, Elohim, is a God of justice. Righteous justice. And you know what that means? If you sin, there is an instantaneous accounting and retribution for your sin that does not leave room for what we call Yom HaKippurim, the Day of Atonement. Now that's mercy. That's a secondary characteristic of God. God created a world, a universe, based on justice. Absolute, pure justice. Now when God saw that the world could not exist, we know why. If that was the nature of His relationship with His creations, because we would just be blown up and there'd be no one else, maybe like three people in the world instead of 7 billion. God said, no. And if you look carefully, there's a second accounting of Genesis. It said that God, Hashem Elohim, created the heavens and the universe. And it uses God's name, the four-letter ineffable name, before the word Elohim. Why? Because Elohim is justice, but the four-letter name is mercy. So He's balancing the mercy and the justice. So there are those individuals in our world today, and have been historically, who God relates to them purely on justice. I'll name you someone who you've all heard of, Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva had a very difficult life. It ended, I mean, you probably know the story. We read about it on Tisha B'Av, the ninth of Av, and on Yom Kippurim. They had his flesh ripped off of him, by, you know, with hot rakes. It was horrible. Why? We don't know the answer, but we do know one thing. That Rabbi Akiva was judged on a higher level than we are. In other words, his relationship with our Creator was pure justice. No ambiguity, no mercy rule. It was just what it was. So whatever tiniest little things that Rabbi Akiva may have done, this was the punishment. And it was given in this world. That was it. Rabbi Akiva is cleansed. He goes to wait for the coming of the Mashiach, of the Messiah. What about the rest of us? Well, we need Yom Kippur, desperately. Every day, three times a day, we can say, please, God, slach lanu avinu kichatanu, or we need the mercy rule. Otherwise, we couldn't exist. So the question of the Talmud is this. Does God get angry every day? Meaning, what if He allowed that midat hadin, the justice rule, to apply every day? Okay. What if during that moment of anger, where justice rules, no more mercy, what if you presented Him sin? How would He respond to that sin? Very simply. nuclear option, correct? So that is what Bilam was able to tap into, as we're going to see. Bilam's strength is that he's the only creature in the history of the world, the only creation of God, who somehow could sense that random moment where God's din, God's justice, is there. In a 24-hour period, there's one moment where if you hold up a picture, let's say, of the Jewish people worshiping the golden calf, and say, Jewish people, what do you think? And he looks at the picture, and it's at the time of absolute justice, the nuclear option is a potential. It's a very scary thing. So now let's go in, now that we understand what it means when God gets angry, it means that he allows justice to be in the world for that moment. Now let's discuss how long that moment is and how variable it is, and maybe a little bit more about Bilam. Okay, so we're on the fourth line of the Talmud. So the Gemara, the Talmud asked, but is anger then a mood of the Holy One, blessed be he? Not, in other words, not anger in response to sin, but just every day, randomly, there's a moment of anger. Yes, the Talmud asks, for it has been taught in a Baraita, in a Mishnaic literature, oral tradition, God is angry every day. But before you get too nervous, now comes the interesting part. And how long does God's anger last? Rega, a moment. Rega, just a moment. Okay, and how long is this moment? 158,888th part of an hour. This is a moment. This is a rega. Stop for a second. There's an argument how long it is. It's either 1/16th or 1/4 of a second. Whoa. That's good news, Ravi. Baruch Hashem. Yes, thank God. I'm thinking, oh my gosh, 24 hours. What if that moment really was a moment, right? We don't know. So it either calculates to 1/4 of a second or 1/16th of a second. Now, the rabbis actually debate, well, if it's 1/4 of a second or 1/16th of a second, what type of curse could you even get in that short a period of time? You know, most curses have, what, about 4 letters, don't they? At least in English, right? So like, you know, what type of good curse could you get in, right? We'll talk about that in a minute. So it's either a 1/16th of a second or 1/4 of a second in every 24-hour period, God gets angry. And then the Talmud says something amazing. I like the way the fact it says Birya in Hebrew. And no creature, doesn't say human being, you notice, doesn't say that? And no creature has ever been able to fix precisely this moment except the wicked Bilam, of whom it is written, and here's our title for tonight's class, Yodea Das Elyon, he knows the mind of the Most High. The Talmud says, oh, come on, he knows the mind of God? What? No, wait a minute, he says. He did not even know the mind of his animal, of his donkey. How could he then know the mind of the Most High? Stop. Now, think. What is Thomas saying? Wait a minute. He somehow can penetrate the mind of God and understand and touch God's feelings, whatever that means. But what about his donkey's feelings? You know, when the donkey sees the angel and stops, he's not able to understand. Maybe the donkey's trying to save his life and doesn't want to go forward because he's about to get killed by the assassin angel with the sword. So he's into feelings of God, which are way out that ethereal track, but his own donkey, that he's totally oblivious to, right? What does it mean? So, in other words, it can't mean a conventional understanding of God's feelings. So what does it mean? Ah, the meaning is therefore only that he, Bilam, knew how to fix precisely the exact moment, the rega, in which the Holy One, blessed is he, is angry. And this is just what the prophet Micah said to Israel. By the way, that Haftorah was read, can you guess which Parsha? Balak, of course, because it's all about Bilam. You know what he said? God said to us, my people, Zechor, and it almost became one of the remembrances that we need to remember every day, the greatness of God's mercy. My people, God said, remember now what Balak, king of Moab, devised, meaning by hiring Bilam, and what Bilam, the son of Beor, answered him, that you may know the righteous acts of the Lord. Now, what does it mean that you may know the righteous acts of the Lord? Rabbi Elazar says in the Gemara and the Talmud, the Holy One, blessed is he, God, said to Israel, See now, how many righteous acts I performed for you in not being angry in the days of the wicked Balaam. For had I been angry, not one remnant would have been left of the enemies of Israel. Stop. The Talmud uses the word enemies of Israel when it's talking about the Jewish people themselves, but it doesn't want to blame the Jewish people. Therefore, the enemies of Israel is referring to who? The Jewish people themselves. In other words, during the episode in Parshat Balak, when Bilam is sort of like probing God, looking for an opening to curse, what happens to that moment, that rega? It doesn't happen. God said, new countenance, fooled you. There's not going to be that 1/16th or 1/4 of a second of anger. So Bilam had no opportunity to curse the Jewish people. Instead, what does he end up doing to us? He blesses us. Matovu ohalacha Yaakov, right? How goodly are your tents, Jacob. How great are the Jewish people. Now, that's the irony, right? Is that Bilam ends up writing some of the most beautiful, profound poetry about the Jewish people ever written. And he's like, I hate to say this word, but he's like a donkey talking. Now, that's the irony, right? Because God puts the words in Bilam's mouth, and he can't stop himself. So he goes back to Balak, the king, and Balak's waiting there. Okay, what happened? Did you curse them? No. And then instead of saying, well, this is what I said, he says, oh, by the way, the Jewish people are untouchable. You, Balak, are going to die. All these great things. And Balak is just like, what? I hired you to curse them, and you're blessing them? But Bilam himself, can you imagine his chagrin, the embarrassment? He's like a donkey. He can't stop the words because God said, this is what you must say. This is what he said. All right, let's get back inside. So in other words, the Talmud is saying that had God gotten angry, had he had that moment during the time that Bilam was looking and probing, the Jewish people would have been extinguished at that time. And this too is the meaning of what Bilam said to Balak. He said, wait a minute, how shall I curse whom God is not cursed? How can I anger when the Lord has not become angry? This teaches us that God was not angry all these days. And then it goes on to say, how long does his anger last? One moment. And then it goes on to tell us another explanation of what a moment be. Please turn to number 8. Bilam saw that it pleased the Lord to bless Israel, so he did not go in search of omens as he had done time and time again, but he turned his face towards the desert. Bilam raised his eyes. Actually, he only had one eye, so he raised his eye, because he had an ayin hara, the evil eye. And he saw Israel dwelling according to its tribes, and the Spirit of God rested upon him. He took up his mashal, his parable, and he said, the word of Bilam, the son of Beor, the word of the man with an open eye, the word of the one who hears God saying, who sees the vision of the Almighty, fallen yet with open eyes. How goodly are your tents, O Jacob, Matov, O Alecha Yaakov, Mishkanatecha Yisrael, your dwelling places, O Israel. What does it mean he went in search of omens? To divine that perhaps God would chance to meet him as he wished. He said, whether God wishes to curse them or not, I will mention their sins so that on the mention of their sins, the curse can take effect. Stop for a second. So let's just take a step back. What have we learned from this Talmud? Something amazing. God gets angry every day. How long? A rega, a moment. That moment is about, you know, a quarter, 16th of a second, about the time it takes to say the word rega in Hebrew. What power did Bilam have? No power to curse at all. But what he did have the power, which we just learned in number 7, in search of omens, is that if he could pinpoint that moment where God's righteous justice is there, what if he could present a picture, a negative picture of the Jewish people to God, and then God has that anger in him, boom, I'm going to respond, because how can I not respond? Now, what I think is amazing, as we'll talk about at the end, is this is what the haters of the Jewish people have done to undermine our Israel, and America, for that matter, in the last 30 or 40 years. So pretend you're a paparazzi for a moment, heaven forbid, okay? And you sit outside Buckingham Palace, and you got your photo lens, and you're just shooting. I don't know, how fast are those speedwinders? They're really fast. They take multiple pictures a second, right? And you're just, you know, there's Charles, there's Diana, whoever, and you're just taking pictures day, night, from trees, from wherever. If I take 100,000 pictures of you in a week, in one picture, you're going to look like an idiot. I mean, how could you not? Whether you're yawning, whether you're eating, whatever it is, a silly facial expression. But what if I just take that one picture out of 100,000 and I publish it in the front of the National Enquirer or the UK Telegraph? This is your king. the heir to the throne. This is Charles, right? And you're like, and everyone's like, oh my gosh. Because we all know that pictures don't lie, right? Well, of course they do. Because what if you strip away from the picture context? Well, who uses us now? The haters of Israel use us all the time, right? Because what they'll do is they'll take film or pictures of incidents that will happen, but they'll just take the response of the Israeli soldier or whatever it is, one little picture totally out of context, with not even an effort to contextualize what you're seeing, and they'll present it to you. You like the Jews? Really, you like it? You support Israel? And they show you the picture. And everyone at the UN goes, oh my gosh, look at that horrific picture. Because how can anyone look good when you're responding to a rock throwing that a couple seconds ago took out the eye of your friend, the soldier, and you're rushing into the crowd to take a little bit of revenge. But you're not hurting anybody. But at the moment you take a picture, boom, and that's all that you present. Well, that's what Bilaam tried to do. In other words, Bilaam looks to the desert and says, well, what did he try to do? He tried to take a snapshot of the most horrific sin at that moment the Jews had done, the golden calf. And what did he want to do? He actually says he peers to the desert with his one eye. He's taking a picture. And if there was a rega, a moment of danger to the Jews, he would just take the snapshot of the Jews, fornicating and committing idolatry in front of the golden calf, and he would hold it up. You like the Jewish people in a one rega. Here you go, right? Kill them. And how could God not respond? He would have to respond. But he didn't respond. Why? Because he didn't allow himself, as the prophet Micah told us, to get angry during that day. Had he gotten angry and had Bilaam presented the right picture, maybe we wouldn't have the class tonight. We don't know, right? Okay. We're running out of time, but what I want to do is I just want to share with you something, and I'll paraphrase what your sources are going to talk about. We pointed to the golden calf as the greatest sin up to that moment in Jewish history. It's interesting that after the golden calf, God says to us, to Moses, better I don't go with you. Better my angel. Hinei malachi yelech lefanecha. My angel's going to go into the promised land. I am stepping back from the picture. Because if I'm with you, listen to the words he says. I'll say in Hebrew. Rega echad v'chiliticha. Rega echad. In one moment of you messing up with close proximity to me, God says, you're dead. I will destroy you. So what's the problem again? Rega. It's that moment of anger. By the way, we say that every single day in your morning liturgy, in your morning prayers. We say in Mizmor Shir Chanukat HaBayit LeDavid, we say, Rega be'apo chayim birtzono. Rega ba'apo. One moment of wrath, of anger. Chayim birtzono. But his goodwill is eternal. We say it every single day. Who do you think that rega is referring to? Bilaam, of course, because he's the only one in history, we're told by the Talmud, who could calculate when that moment was. So God says to Moses in number 9, he says, if I go up in your midst for one moment, rega, chiliticha, I will destroy you. You rebel, you mess up, you're dead. So what did Moses respond? What did he say? Number 11. He says, but God, what's the problem with the moment? Oh, if you get angry and the prophet Bilaam's around, we're in heap big trouble. Okay, what if we kill Bilaam then? What's the problem then? There's no danger. So that's what he asks for. Number 11. For how then will it be known? In other words, how will the finding of favor be known if it is not in that you will go with us? One thing that I ask of you, Moses says, that your Shekhinah, your holy divine presence, shall no longer rest upon heathen nations. Who is he speaking about? He wants Bilaam to be stripped of his prophetic divine abilities. And what does Bilaam say at the very end of our parsha, number 12? And now Bilaam says, I am going to my people. Come, I'll advise you, King Balak, what this people, the Jewish people, will do to your people at the end of days. Number 13. I am going to my people, Bilaam's closing words to Balak. From now on, I am like the rest of my people, for the Holy One, blessed is he, has departed from now. Stop. So, in the aftermath of the golden calf, God says, I will no longer be in your midst. It's too dangerous for me to have proximity to you. Moses says, if you won't come in my midst, if you won't be with us, if it's your angel, I'm staying here. Necheni na mesifrecha. Erase me from the book. I'm not part of this. It's either you, God, or I'm not leaving Mount Sinai. It's pretty heavy words. God says, okay, but what about the rega? Rega echad v'chiviticha. But don't you understand that if I'm in close proximity to you and you are going to sin, what if you sin at the wrong moment? At that rega, you're dead. Moses says, but God, nobody knows when that moment is. Bilam does. So what's Moses' question? And what's his retort? Kill Bilam, then we don't have to worry about the rega. So he davens at that moment, v'niflinu anivamcha. If you will distinguish us from your other nations of the world by getting rid of Bilam, by defrocking Bilam of his magical powers, if there's no Bilam, there's no danger of the moment. So at the moment where God is choosing how he will relate to his people, it's already an issue of will Bilam be successful or not. And in the end, Moses' prayer is listened to, and Bilam leaves the end of our parsha, defrocked, gone. He becomes a sorcerer for hire, not a prophet, not able to calculate the rega. So now let's step back for a moment. We asked earlier on, Pirkei Avot, Ethics for Our Fathers, draws a comparison between Abraham and Bilam. It says you have to be a student of one or the other. So again, who has more students in our world today? Now what is Bilam? Let's just analyze for a second. He's really the ultimate father of what we call postmodernism. And if you don't know a lot about postmodernism, I don't know if you've studied it or not, but suffice it to say that postmodernism strips meaning from everything that happens in this world. In other words, Bilam says, for example, you got out of Egypt. You're feeling proud. The Jewish people were saved from Pharaoh. How about I show you another way of looking at this? And you're not such hot stuff. What if it was just coincidental? What if things just worked out that way? Because it's random. So Bilam will strip away from what we call context, meaning to things. He'll just say, well, you could look at it this way, but you could also look at it this way. We know pictures can be interpreted by the interpreter. In other words, whatever you choose to read into the picture is your understanding of the picture. You see it this way, I see it this way. And that's what Bilam was a master of. In other words, he could break down everything in our world to what? The rega, to the moment. Now think about it for a second. If you're only concerned with the second, the moment that we're living in, but not the past, not the future, then there is absolutely zero context. It's just text. It's what it is. So then how do you interpret the text? By reading it, right? In other words, when we read into something. That's why it's so critical. I mean, how scary is it to put on a television show and you take words, like, you know, there's an interview with somebody, you're trying to make heads or tails of what in the world is the subject? What are they talking about? And sometimes you actually get the wrong impression and you're like, holy smokes, I can't believe he said this. And then, of course, you miss the first 2 minutes of the conversation. So your context is totally erroneous. It's not me at all. But what if everything in life was like that? What if everything in life was devoid of meaning because it only is what it is in front of you? That's what Bilam does. That's what postmodernism does. I mean, think about it. We believed, for example, as Israel, were on the side of the righteous. But then there are people who say, oh, believe me, I know you're going to laugh. I heard this from a religious Jew. I said, well, what about the miracle that happened in our own lives that transformed our world, the Six-Day War in 67? The person said to me, it's not really a miracle. The Arabs could have won the war, but they weren't really trying. Now, after I picked myself up off the sukkah floor, it was during Sukkot, I said, what? Is this based on, like, Nasser's memoirs? Where is this from? Well, you know, they kind of didn't really try. They had one hand tied behind their back. They allowed their airplanes to be bombed on the runway, the Egyptian Air Force. Holy smokes, this is a religious Jew? I mean, and my wife and I were just stunned, okay? But this is Bilam, right? Because Bilam can simply take something we believe to be a truth, a reality, with context, and strip it away and say, well, you think you're hot stuff and it means so much to you, but I will show you another another interpretation of it. Because after all, if there's no future and there's no past, if there's only the now, the rega, the moment, I can read into it whatever I want to read into it. And isn't that what our world does today? Isn't it what it has done successfully to our beloved America? I mean, it's under attack every single day. From the past doesn't mean anything, and it's all a joke. We're all a bunch of vicious people who have all we ever done in our lives. It's without any meaning, and any meaning we had was nefarious. And Israel, again, built by a bunch of Zionist, you know, interlopers who are occupying territory, didn't belong. There's no, right? That's why it's okay for the guy in the keffiyeh to literally stand, do you remember this? Unforgettable video, where he stands in front of the Kotel HaMaravi, the Western Wall, Arafat, Yimach Shemo, and he points to the wall and says, there's no proof of a Jewish presence here. I'm thinking, there's no proof? There's a Western Wall that you could maybe carbon date and find out. You guys weren't around back then. You guys didn't even come into being until the year 600 or so. So what exactly, but he said it with a straight face, and the world just took pictures and they presented it as reality. So again, who has more students in the world today? Bilam HaRasha, the wicked Bilam, and his version of a world that is cold, that is bereft of meaning, no context, no purpose to the past or the future. Or Abraham, who puts everything in our past. Because if you don't have a past, you can't live now or for the future, which is the belief that we have as the Jewish people. So just to close, I think that Bilam, now we see how serious a person he was, that he really was a contender. He could have been the Moses of the Jewish people. But instead of leading the nations to the summit of Sinai, he took them to degrade themselves, to humiliate themselves. And ultimately, if the Torah treats him in an unfair way, it's only because he brought this upon himself. I mean, you see every step of the way, God desperately wanted to protect Bilam from himself, the talking donkey, etc. All of it was because I want Bilam to do something good for this world. And instead, he turns around and manipulates God's dark side, and we understand a little bit of the rega. Bilam, the man who knew the mind of God, he really did understand one little part of the mind of God. And yet, he destroyed himself because he had his little agenda. And that's, I think, the takeaway from tonight. That the agenda that we bring to the table can strip away meaning and context the same way that reading into something in a picture. So with that, I hope that we've shed some light on at least the Shrek movie. On the talking donkey, you won't see that again, okay? And I wish everyone a wonderful, wonderful week. Shabbat shalom.